We're going to talk about junior hockey to lead off the show today. I don't know who isn't in the hockey world, considering that venerable OHL Commissioner Dave Branch came down and suspended the owner of the Flint Firebirds, the management of the Flint Firebirds, the new coaching staff of the Flint Firebirds, after they fired their coaches for the second time this season after giving them both 3-year contracts after the first time they were fired.
I wonder how legit those contracts were. That's one of the questions that's out there right now. But what happened to John Gruden, Dave Karpa, et cetera. Here's the reward tonight for the Flint Firebirds, who play this evening, have 3 games at home, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. The Flint Firebirds, mired in this entire controversy, who once again fire their coaching staff, who now suspend ownership and management tonight at home, face off against the top team in the country, the Erie Otters. Not just top team in the OHL, the top team in the entire CHL, the Dylan Strome-led Erie Otters. By the way, this note for Sammy, there's an echo right now in my voice. If you can do something with the headphones or something, I don't know.
I turned mine down. Maybe that'll do it.
All right, that might do it. Nah, it's still there, but we'll work on it. Hey, it's the podcast. Yeah, well, like, honestly, like, seriously, which I just got off SiriusXM with Cooley talking about this too. Like, at this point, you have to say to yourself, "Oh, it's a lot better now, Sammy. Good job." At this point, you have to say to yourself, you have to seriously look at revoking the franchise. Like, in one season, you have 2 colossal blunders, which has, you know, embarrassed the OHL, to say nothing of what it's done to every other player on that team, including the owner's son, which is what this is all about. He's not getting the ice time. Why is he not getting the ice time? Well, because he's not a major junior hockey player. You know, at best, he should be playing, you know, in tier 2. At best, he's not cut out for major junior
hockey. But before you go on, though, like, that was one of the most fascinating parts of this whole story, was the fact that the owner's son, owner being Håkan Nielsen, and Rolf Nielsen being the owner of the team, that his son actually took part in that protest earlier this year when the coaches were fired initially, where the players walked up and handed in their jerseys and basically quit on the team. He was one of them. So you'd figure by this point the message would be heard from son to father, butt out, old man.
I wonder how much of that was going along with the crowd. I was told when it first happened that a lot of the players, after that win against the Oshawa Generals, the big overtime win, hey, it's party time and it's celebrations. The next thing you know, they're throwing the jerseys on the Costa Papista, the president's office floor, in the conga line led by Alex Nedeljkovic, the Carolina Hurricanes netminding prospect. You know, I was told that a lot of the players in the dressing room, rightly or wrongly, perhaps wrongly, ganged up on Håkan Nielsen.
Oh, really?
And at times it got pretty ugly. Yeah.
Oh, really?
That it wasn't exactly a lovely scenario. So how much was the kid pressured to say, hey, Dad, back off? Hey, Dad, you've got to fix this. I mean, Dave Branch, you know, made that drive to Flint to calm everything down and essentially say, look, reinstate the coaching staff. Here's the extensions for the team. It is also believed that at that time, John Gruden, even though Terry Christensen was technically the general manager, that Gruden was promised the general manager title at that time. That's very much a speculation. But at that point, Dave Branch said, in no way, shape, or form, Rolf, that's the owner, can you have anything to do with the day-to-day operations of the Flint Firebirds? You need to keep this thing at arm's length. You can't meddle. We're not just talking about your team and your son. We're talking about the development and psychological well-being of all the other kids that play there, whether they're, you know, the third-pairing defenseman or whether it's a potential first-round draft pick in Will Bitten, to say nothing of a Detroit Red Wings prospect, Ville Sarajärvi, who you can be certain, Greg, will not be going to Flint. I can tell you for a fact that Ken Holland wants Sarajärvi as far away from this situation as possible.
As he should.
If you know anything about how the Red Wings run their affairs, this is not acceptable. And if they could place him somewhere else right now, I'm sure they would. I mean, you have in Ken Campbell's piece in the Hockey News, Will Bitten's dad, Michael, saying he ain't coming back next year unless there's changes. I don't blame him. You wonder how many kids have been harmed through all of this. I mean, the smart ones were the guys that escaped. Well, the lucky ones were the guys that escaped. Right, Josh Wesley escaped, he goes to Niagara. Alex Nedeljkovic, he goes to Niagara, he escapes as well. What about the other one? So what happens? So Rolf Nielsen tells David Branch, oh yes, no problem, I'm at arm's length, don't worry. So he brings in his buddy, Sergey Karin, who now all of a sudden is essentially doing the owner's bidding as his proxy. And the players have no trust in this guy whatsoever. And he's, he's one of the people that's been suspended. It was weird, Greg. Like, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Sergey Karin just appears.
Yeah, that's the really weird part.
Jeff shows up.
He's suspended, too. I was very interested. I don't know if this... If this is just a by virtue of it being a junior hockey team we're talking about or whatever here, but in the big long press release from the OHL announcing all of these suspensions today and these investigations, there was a lot of talk in there about counseling for the players and therapy for the players. Is that just them being proactive because these kids are young, or are we talking about like actual palpable psychological damage because of the situation that's happened in Flint?
I think it's a tough situation for a kid who's away from home, living in a billet family, away from the family situation, supposed to be on a development curve in pivotal hockey development years, completely getting, steamrolled by this story that's made a mockery and an embarrassment of their organization. I'm sure that can be psychologically damaging on kids, whether you're Sari Arvi, Will Bitten, or someone who's, going to go play the CIS route and professional hockey isn't on the horizon for you. This is not an easy situation. I mean, you can be assured that at some point there were probably some uncomfortable situations, whether it's through Sergey Karin, whether it's through Rolf Nilsson himself, that players were put in a position where as children, as kids, they did not know how to react and did not know how to act. And mom and dad aren't there. They're as close as a phone call, but it's not like they can go to mom and dad's house. I don't know what went on in that room. I've heard a lot of horrible stories. I've heard a lot of bad junior hockey stories of how this team was treated, whether it's, through ownership or through management, not through John Gruden, not through Dave Karpa. Okay. That's not who I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the people above them, that the psychological counseling doesn't surprise me at all, and good for the OHL for being proactive on it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
So it's a disgrace. Like, honestly, I can't, like, normally, I provide a soft landing for a lot of things, not for this one. Like, this is revoke the franchise right now from this guy. I know he's rich, and I know why he got the franchise, because the OHL wanted to do Peter Karmanos a solid. He'd already sold the rink, USA Hockey. Plymouth didn't have a tenant. They had to move the franchise. Flint wasn't the preferred destination. I'm sure Rolf Nilsson wasn't the preferred buyer, but considering what Peter Karmanos had done for the OHL, developing players, developing coaches, like the way that Peter Karmanos kept that franchise alive and thriving and consistently competitive, I'm pretty sure the Board of Governors in the OHL wanted to do a solid for Peter and give him a shot at getting most of his money back, the money that he had lost by owning the junior hockey team. This is what happens when, and I don't know whether the OHL did or did not do proper due diligence. Right now, I would suggest they didn't, considering we're in a situation where not once but twice you've had, the owner, severely reprimanded and now suspended. This is nothing but an unmitigated embarrassment for the Ontario Hockey League.
That said, I mean, why don't they just sell the team to Tom Golisano?
Hey, how about this one? Because they wanted to keep a franchise in Michigan. I mean, this is a great, I mean, these are, great teams for the OHL, but they're also recruiting teams. So American kids in the area can, go to a Plymouth Whalers game, go to a Flint Firebirds game, go to an Erie Otters game and say, wow, this is the level of competition that they have in the OHL. I want to go there, as opposed to, going the NCAA route. Like, I'm not going to call them specific recruiting teams, but those are teams that show kids in that area, what the product is like. Like, I mean, the Western Hockey League has that with their U.S. division. The Quebec Major Junior Hockey League doesn't have that. They've tried in places like Lewiston, but it hasn't worked and it hasn't taken hold. And that's one of the reasons why they have a hard time, outside of the language barrier, which is a big one as well, but they have a hard time recruiting from the Northeast in their geographical territory. A lot of those kids are married to playing Division I anyhow, and they're not going to go. Plus, the language barrier creates another barrier to entry and keeps kids away from the QMJHL. But the OHL has done very well having teams in that area and keeping teams in that area to show, young elite-level hockey players what the level of play is in the OHL. So they want to keep a team in that area. But at this point, do you not just say to yourself, like, Greg, to your point about telling the team, how about a phone call to Terry Pegula? Hey, Terry, do you want a junior team as well?
Right. That makes
sense,
wouldn't it?
You want a team in Buffalo, right? Then all of a sudden you have the Niagara Ice Dogs and the Buffalo whatevers with a natural rivalry. I don't know. I'm just spitballing this whole thing. But to the end of it, You know, this is the first season. You know, either there's, I mean, think about it this way. So we all know about the woes of Flint right now with the water situation. So difficult, you know, city situation. Now you throw this hockey situation into it. The Flint Firebirds, I want to say, have 12 picks in the draft this year in the OHL, two of which, if the season stopped today, would be pick number 2 and 5 overall. Last year, Ryan McLeod refused to report. They ended up trading him to Mississauga. How the hell can any responsible parents, right? You're a father, Wish. I'm a father.
Mm-hmm.
How
yeah.
can any responsible parent send their kid to Flint if they're drafted there? Like, if you're a scout, good luck recruiting. Just, you know, right. resign or try to find a job somewhere else. Because yeah. I can't imagine any responsible, well-thinking person, right, who would send their kid to play for the Flint Firebirds. Not a chance.
Yeah. Not a chance. No,
by the way,
point.
Looks like Joe Steffen will coach tonight.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
As we're wondering, that's the from a couple of calls that I've placed. That seems the I haven't got that.
Now, for those who don't know the name, who is he?
Assistant general manager of the team. He's one of the only ones not suspended right now. you sort of look around the room and say, okay, A, who can coach? B, who's not suspended?
That's funny. That's really funny.
Yeah.
All right, so we've got that whole thing, and it's just going to be a big mess. So Endgame is going to be what, do you think, there? They force them to sell the team?
I would think so.
Okay.
Can they do that, though, is the question. Well, that's where I don't know the OHL constitution vis-a-vis franchise sale or for sale. I know that there are sanctions that the commissioner can make, and I've even heard that you could actually revoke a franchise. I don't know that for a fact, but if there's ever a case to be made for revoking a franchise, that's this one. The problem becomes now, you know, we're not dealing with a millionaire in Rolf Nilsson, we're dealing with a billionaire. Like, if somebody wants to lawyer up, Rolf Nilsson can lawyer up. Like, if this thing wants to get really ugly, then it can. But this little vanity project for Håkan Nilsson needs to stop. It's embarrassing and it's destructive for everybody else on the team.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of embarrassing and destructive, Dennis Weidman's 20-game suspension upheld yesterday by the National Hockey League and Gary Bettman.
No surprise.
I mean, super predictable, but the real intrigue in this obviously was, how are they going to handle the NHLPA's dispute that the play in question, the cross-checking of Don Henderson in the back that concussed Henderson and all that was the result of Weidman's own concussion. And in reading the settlement, it was really, I mean, mm-hmm. I secretly love reading Gary Bettman's appeal dissertations. I think they're fabulous. He's a snarky little brat when he writes about this stuff, and it's fun to read. So I really enjoyed him picking apart the NHLPA argument. Basically, it boils down to this. The experts they put in front of the NHL didn't have any physical evaluation of Weidman in person. They did everything over FaceTime. They basically took his word for it. So Bettman just kind of struck everything down there. But more importantly, as was exemplified by a text message acquired by the National Hockey League, he didn't buy Weidman's testimony about his mental state and about his contrition for what happened with the linesman.
You know, I wonder how much, the guys were just talking about this on Hockey Central with Elliot. I wonder how much, you know, the reveal of the text message is a tit for tat for what the NHLPA has brought up in various hearings with the NHL about good PR that the NHL can accrue from proper suspensions.
Not only that, but, I'm sure it's a chilling effect for a lot of these guys to know that, you know, everything that they say or do can be acquired by the NHL.
It's one text. We don't have context for it, right? We don't have tone. That's the one thing. I mean, how many times have we all been tripped up on tone? Oh, you know what? Whether it's tweets or whether it's text, you can't tell, you know, whether
every single laugh. Day.
You can't, right? You can't tell context for it. It doesn't look good, but who hasn't, you know, said something they really didn't mean, but they regret it. But it is interesting that they would bring it up. And isn't it interesting that they would make it public? That's the big
well,
one.
I think,
the big one. That's the
I,
big one for me. That how,
I think they had
and I'm,
to.
And I'm with
well,
you. I love reading Gary's dissertation on it. Because I'm with you. Like, whether you like him or not, the one thing we've always talked about on this program is he's the smartest guy in the room always. And we, when Gary gets his lawyer on, look out. It can get nasty pretty fast. And we saw this in this dissertation. One of my fascinations is how that was made public.
Yeah, and I think he did it just for the emphasis of this. I could have given him a longer suspension. I chose not to, yada, yada, yada. But yep. Again, like, the biggest thing for me in this whole thing is how do they deal with the concussion part of it?
Yeah.
It seemed much more of a what they did here, I think, and what Bettman did here was say, in this situation, you could not prove that the concussion led to the actions. And although he made mention in his appeal ruling that maybe the science isn't necessarily there, I'm paraphrasing, that a concussion would cause someone to do this, basically they took the Weidman thing and said, here's this deal, here's why we don't buy it, and yeah, didn't make a blanket ruling that concussions can't be used as an excuse for actions. I think they were very particular about this situation here versus making a blanket statement about that phenomena.
It would open up, we talked about this before, it would really open up a whole new door and travel us down a new hallway if all of a sudden concussions get used as defense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm not saying it can't be used as defense. Right? Like, just because it's never happened before doesn't mean that it can't happen. And again, I will have to defer to a doctor on this, or defer to someone who's had a concussion and immediately done something that they've looked back on and said, I have no idea why I did that.
Well, and that's the really weird part about this too. Like, I wonder what Weidman's deal would be if he had just come out after the incident and said, yeah, I was concussed. Because in the document, Bettman says that Weidman was told not to discuss any of that stuff. Yeah. And I'm guessing it's because of the concussion protocol that wasn't followed by the Flames, where literally someone comes to him before he meets the media after the game. And why is he meeting the media after that? Jesus. And tells him, don't tell anybody about what you're feeling or that you might have had a concussion, because the protocol wasn't followed. So it's just a giant mess.
Yeah,
just a giant mess up and down.
Yeah, a giant mess. And I was at the Conn Smythe sports dinner last night, and Brian Burke was one of the speakers, and Bill Daly was on the panel as well, raising money for Easter Seals. And it was interesting because Brian was, of course, asked about it and talked about how very strongly, like really strongly, they disagree, obviously, with the NHL upholding the 20-game suspension. You know what I'm thinking right now if I'm the Calgary Flames?
What's that?
I'm thinking I'm screwed.
Why?
And I need to go through this and have a look at the average penalty minutes for the Calgary Flames pre Don Henderson and post Don Henderson. Pre Don Henderson, you know, they were one of the lowest penalty minute teams in the NHL. And then, you know, there was a game that we did last Thursday where, you know, there's five interrupted, very questionable penalties and one icing, which I firmly believe they got burned on. And I know here I am, you know, casting aspersions on the officials, but if you know anything from me on this podcast, the last thing I do is cast aspersions on officials. But if I'm the Calgary Flames, very quietly, because you can't see anything publicly, I'm nervous.
I really am. Why wasn't Brian Burke in the room for this, by the way, for this hearing?
Don't know.
True Living was there. Yeah. And Weidman was there. I found that to be don't you find that to be extraordinarily odd, considering that we've had higher officials than a general manager in these hearings before, and considering the fact that Brian used to be on the other side of the table for these?
And Brian testified on behalf of the NHL against the Ilya Kovalchuk contract.
Yeah.
Like, he was there in the room with the NHL saying, I think this is BS. I'm with the NHL on this one.
So, I mean, you want my theory on it? You want my unintelligent theory, my pure speculation theory, my theory that will likely get me. Go ahead.
So yesterday he went at the NHL hard in front of Bailey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
My theory on this, and I'll you know a, 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 you know, anticipate the Patrick Burke text that I'll get in trying to say this.
Okay.
Is that I don't think Brian wants to say that on the record in the room to Gary's face. I think Brian Burke in his heart knows that Weidman screwed up, and that if he was on the other side of the table, he would have given the same suspension Coley gave him. His main gripe with the NHL was how much time it took for them to issue the suspension versus the suspension itself. There was much more vitriol coming from Berkey about that than the suspension itself. I don't think in good conscience he could go in there and argue on behalf of some guy that he knows did something terrible and attacked a referee or attacked a linesman.
That's your theory on it?
That's my theory on it, is that Brian, because he was in that role before.
Brian really doesn't believe, because Brian used to fill that role as the sheriff.
He was the sheriff. If he was still the sheriff, he would have done the same damn thing Colin Campbell did. He would have. And I think he knows that. I don't think he can go in there in good faith and sit on the other side of the table and look at Gary Bettman and try to argue the fact that, you know, what Bettman's saying in the situation is wrong.
I don't know because Brian, like, the one that I go back to with Brian Burke when he was head of discipline in the NHL was the McSorley Eric Lindros biting incident where, Brian couldn't do anything in his mind unless Marty admitted to him that Eric Lindros bit him, and Marty wouldn't do that, and Brian couldn't do anything. So, look, we can do something here, but unless he wasn't prepared to just polish his badge, get up on his horse, and be the sheriff, unless he had something corroborated through the players. I'm not sure whether Gary would have. I'm not sure whether Brian had that in his MO at that time that he would have done the exact same thing that Colin Campbell did.
I don't know, man. There's a part of me that thinks...
I still think that there's a lot of Brian Burke that falls on the side of the player. I really do. And I go back to me, one of the big ones was the Marty Eric incident with the biting. Which, listen, man, everybody freaking knew that Eric bit him. All right?
Yeah.
And Marty said, look, Brian, he didn't bite me, and I'll call Bobby Clark and tell him he owes me one. That was in one of the great lines of all time. But Brian couldn't do it. But Brian
I just think
it, and he wouldn't do it.
Player attacks an official when it's something
attack
that cut and dry.
Attack is so strong.
Attack is what happened. He got a 20-game suspension for it. He attacked him.
Just because he got a 20-game suspension, that's one person's interpretation of it. Or was he dazed and going back to the bench and foggy, and next thing you knew, he saw something in a black helmet in front of him, and as a hockey player, you're trained when you see that, you get your hands up right away?
I can't say attacked because he got 20 games for it.
Just because he got to the game, it doesn't mean that you have to agree with it.
Of course you do. That means he attacked him.
That appeals. I disagree with that, though. I don't think it was.
Why?
I don't.
But on my side of the ledger, I have a 20-game suspension that says he attacked someone, and on your side of the ledger, I disagree with the thing that says he attacked him.
That's right. Because
so I've got the wind in my sails.
You're doing the appeal to authority, and because authority says that it's so, then it must be right. And I'm saying, well, no, that's not true.
I'm not saying he was convicted.
I'm not buying the appeal to authority on this one.
If he had gotten 10 games, I wouldn't use attack. 10 games means it was an oopsie accident. My head was all wibbly wobbly, and I ran into the guy on the way to the bench.
So
20 games means he attacked him.
So you think that Salamaki hits Weidman, he goes up the ice and, oh, man, I'm going to get me some Henderson here. Oh, Henderson's going to pay.
I think he didn't get a penalty on the hit. He was pissed off, and he took his frustrations out on the first stripes that he saw. That's what I think.
I see it different way. I see it. He was fogged going back to the bench. He was pissed off that he just got drilled into the boards. Next thing he knew, outside of his vision was a black helmet in front of him. And your instinct as a hockey player is to put your hands up fast.
You think he was defending himself?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you think he attacked Don Henderson?
With a shove to the back?
You think he went up the ice looking for Don Henderson?
I don't think his actions were defensive. I think they were offensive.
I completely disagree. He saw a black helmet in front of him and he got his hands up.
Wow, that is nutty.
I don't think so. Talk to hockey players.
I that's fine. Hockey players will could tell you a lot of things about a lot of things. I know what the video shows, which is that ain't one defensive. You know what defensive is? Hugging the guy. Hugging the guy is defensive.
No, not when you're a hockey player and you're on the ice and you see a 6-foot body in front of you.
Yeah, you just plow through it then, right? You just raise your gloves and your stick and plow through it.
You've just been hit and you're coasting to the bench and you don't see Henderson, you know, fading back into you. All of a sudden there's a black helmet in front of you and instinctively you put up your hand.
Just so I'm clear here, are you defending the action?
No, I'm saying it was sloppy. I'm saying that he didn't have his wits about him. He wasn't paying attention. What he did was sloppy, and therefore it was punishable. But I'm not going to call it an attack.
So you're saying that if you don't...
I don't think he went looking for Don Henderson. I'm going to fill my boots with Henderson here.
So your problem here is that you think the word attack means premeditation.
Correct.
It can't simply just be that someone doesn't have their wits about them and attacks the first thing they see.
No, I don't think he attacked. I think he got his hands up because he saw something in front of him, which is what you're trained to do. Oh, shit, I'm going to get hit. I got to block this.
Yeah.
As every hockey player does when something is in front of him. I don't think he had intent to go and hunt down Don Henderson.
Right.
I don't. I think he was sloppy because at that moment he wasn't paying attention. Whether it's because he was pissed off he got hit, whether he was concussed and foggy, I don't know. I'm not Dennis Weidman. All I know is I'm pretty sure he didn't go headhunting Don Henderson on that play.
Wasn't there a situation recently where a guy got hit and then he got up and then he just went after the first guy?
Bobby Farnham on Dmitry Yastrzemski.
Yeah,
that's right. St. Louis.
And he got four
games.
Wouldn't you call that an attack?
That was an attack, yes, because we saw him. He got up. He looked at him. And he turned into the Farnham and Bailey circus and went nuts at him.
But he didn't have his wits about him.
You don't think so?
No, he got hit.
He got up. He looked at Yaskin, skated at him, and dropped him. This is a player coming from the corner, coasting to the bench.
But what if he had
moving his feet?
But what if he had a wet noodle upstairs? What if he didn't know what he was doing? It's not an attack then, is it?
No indication of a concussion whatsoever.
Yeah, just like Weidman.
He looked straight at Yaskin, took what, 3 strides, and dropped him. He saw another player and ran at him.
But bring it back to Weidman for a second. Like, don't you think it's a little problematic that the concussion all of a sudden happened to crop up days afterwards?
I know. The whole thing is a mess.
Okay.
Right from the moment of, you know, I'm not going to go to the back. I'm going back on the ice.
That's why I don't necessarily buy the whole thing where he had a foggy mind or something. Like, the concussion, I agree with Bettman. The concussion happened to come to the forefront conveniently after he became public enemy number one internationally for defending himself against a linesman. There, I'll use your terminology.
I don't know. Okay, I don't know whether he had a concussion. All I know is he was sloppy skating back to the bench and wasn't aware of his surroundings. He was pissed off that he got hit, probably end of his shift, I'm done, I'm going back to the bench, and I'm not paying attention to the play. He's not looking at the play at all. It looks like he's pissed off at himself going back to the bench. But I'm not in his head. I don't know if he's concussed, I don't know if he's foggy. I do know that he's being sloppy at that point because he's on the ice and he's not aware of what's going on around him, whether that's by choice or whether that's by concussion. Whether he can form intent or not, he is not paying attention to what's happening. Next thing he knows, in his brain, I suspect, is a black helmet in front of him. Is it a player? Is it an official? I don't know, but he gets his hands up.
How many games would you have given him? Would you give him 10 or 20?
Yeah, I probably would have given him 10 or less. Hmm. I wouldn't have gone 20, but I know why they did.
All right.
This is all according to the playbook I'm not going to pat ourselves in the back here, but I guess I am, that we kind of laid out when it first happened.
Here's oh, no, for sure.
The NHL is going to come real harsh because they don't want the NHL officials to get upset and, you know, start to slow down the game. Like, honestly, like if they would have given them 5 games and the officials would have, you know, collectively, audibly been significantly pissed off, and then how would the NHL have reacted if the NHL officials started calling the rule book? Like, honestly, Greg, really calling the rule book. Like, because you could call a penalty every single shift. If you ended up, like, collectively, and this would be like a wildcat strike almost, but this would be like a work to rule would be better phrase. If the NHL official said, all right, if you're not going to penalize, we're going to penalize. No more feel for the game here, boys. Every time you see an infraction, however slight it might be, you call it. We have a rule book. They've given us a rule book and said, call the rule book. No more feel for the game. We're calling this thing. And it's 60 minutes of penalties.
Well, then you know what you'd have? You'd have the Hurricanes and the Oilers back in the cup final because it'd be 506 all over again.
but you know what I mean? Like that's what the NHL, I think, was very sensitive about, and they should be sensitive about. And I understand that. Like, everything so far has gone according to script. Like, the only surprise here is the Weidman email. The Weidman text has been introduced, but I can't say, I don't think you can either. And if you're being completely honest, I can't think that you're surprised by any of this. The 20 game suspension or the NHL saying, yep, we did the right thing. I'm opposing a suspension. None of it is surprising.
No, I none of it's surprising. Like I said, the only intrigue was how they'd go about justifying it. And the way they did it was surgical and exact and very interesting to see, Bettman, rule the way he did yesterday. Not in the sense of the upheld the suspension, but in the sense of how he justified it.
As far as reading material for justification of a suspension, I mean, the commissioner painted a Picasso. I think to your point as well. Fascinating. Yeah. I encourage everyone to go read it.
Yeah, it's great.
Just for a peek inside the mind of Gary Bettman.
For sure. And he relishes it too. It's you could tell. He's just like,
oh man, come on. Like if you were a trained lawyer, don't you live for those kind of moments where you can roll up your sleeves and say, all right,
light the candle.
Now it's go time.
Lighting a candle, putting on some Grateful Dead in the background and just sitting at his oaken desk in Casa de Bettman somewhere in North Jersey,
right,
banging out
right.
that appeals thing.
Grace, hold my calls. It may take a while.
All right. You got a boogie. We got a guest coming up. Congrats, by the way, to our old friend, Andy Petrello. I understand she is now the lead for Leafs Lunch over on the other network.
Yeah, I saw Andy a couple of days ago and went and had a coffee with her. So I'm so thrilled. Even though it's a competition, so thrilled that Andy becomes the first female sports host of her own program in this country's history in radio. Can you believe that? Like for sports radio. Now the Fan, when Nelson Millman ran it, I mean, they picked up the Fabulous Sports Babe syndicated, and Barb DiGiulio would do fill-in here and there on the station, but Andy's the first, you know, full-time female anchor on a sports show in Canada.
Man, I almost forgot about the Fabulous Sports
Band. Hang on, but back to Petrello. Good for her, man. That I remember Andy. I think she did Newmarket Hurricanes game on local television when she first started out and got her big break with Leafs TV as an anchor there. And she took over when I went to Sportsnet on the iDesk. And she's covered, you know, Olympic games. She's been an anchor for CBC Sports. I think she's when I talked to her the other week, she was still on her, still doing Olympics for CBC. So she'll be going to Brazil for the 3 weeks of glory.
She was on our podcast.
She's a total sweet. I went to her wedding. Okay. My quick story about Andy. Andy had, here's how you know that Andy, works in media. Her wedding, was it 4 years ago? So me and Claire went to it and it was in Kleinburg, Ontario, which is a small little town. Surprise. Actually, the same town that Strombolopoulos is from. Small little town, tiny little cathedral, and nice little reception area outside as well. Here's how you know Andy works in television. The whole thing, okay, from when everyone got seated to we're done and let's go out and have drinks on the patio, the whole thing, 22 minutes. A perfect half an hour show. This was a made-for-TV wedding. We start at top of the hour, we're out clean at 30, and then the whole night begins. She was, I'm like, Andy, you know that timed out at 22 minutes. She's like, oh, come on, guy, it's TV. TV wedding, Andy Petrello, 22-minute wedding.
Wow, nicely done.
She's awesome. Congrats, Andy.
Anything else you want to add before we say farewell?
Doing Nashville and Boston tonight and doing some prep, some interesting stuff coming out of some people sort of whispering behind the scenes in Nashville. Don't be surprised if they're frisky come trade deadline time. And I would not be surprised if we see a former Nashville Predator make his way back to Nashville.
Someone on the blue line?
Someone on the Blue Jackets.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Seth Jones? Oh.
Seth Jones back. Ah, we made him back. Yeah. No, it's They want a little bit of snarl up front. Don't be surprised to make a serious push for Scott Hartnell.
I really would have loved to have seen Hartnell in the Penguins. That's who I was kind of pulling for.
It would be pretty cool. Yeah,
that'd be really cool.
Wouldn't surprise me to see if Nashville ends up trying to get him back.
And then we'll give out the deets on this, the formal deets on this soon. But mark your calendars down for March 23rd. Is that correct?
Yeah, man.
March 23rd will be the next Merrick versus Wyshynski live podcast and extravaganza in the great city of Toronto
March 23rd. Yeah, March 23rd, so make your way, and if you're in the area, pick up your tickets. Should be a lot of fun. I think we'll probably have more dramatic readings of Thunder and Lightning, and probably some more bits as we run out of things to talk about. We'll just gimmick this thing up. And I don't have the exact date, but I was talking to Kevin yesterday. It looks like we got our draft party all set to go for Buffalo.
Yes, that's going to be insane.
So that should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that Buffalo one is going to be one where the tickets will go very fast, and you'll want to get them, because with everybody that's going to be in town for that, that might just be like the Golden Globe Awards of hockey podcasts.
That could be a lot of fun. That one's going to be a lot of fun. But yeah, March 23rd, Toronto, the next MVSW live podcast as part of Puck Talks. So that should be
all
fun.
Right. There you go. Yeah, be well, Merrick.
We'll talk to you.
We're going to talk some Hurricanes, some Carolina Hurricanes, with a new friend, Mike Maniscalco.
Again, with the last
Sam's going to tell me how to say the last name before he comes on. That's what Sam's going to do, I hope. God willing.
Sammy's a good boy that way. Well, good luck wrestling with the language.
All right.
And I'll check you out soon, pal.
Talk to you soon.
Go Flint Firebirds.
There he goes. Jeff Merrick. Dennis Wyman apologist Jeff Merrick. Who knew? It's like finding out one of your best friends is going to vote for Trump. It's like that. Self-defense, my Aunt Fanny. All right. Hurricane Talk coming up. Game Show Thursday coming up as well. But, Sammy, if we could first, I believe it is time to start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet, Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
See, the problem with trying to do a French accent is I only do it one way, and I don't want to be offensive to the French-speaking listeners that we have, because my French accent is always
I am tired of talking about all of the power plays.
See, but here's the problem, because what you're talking about is classic French from France. The French they speak more so in Quebec, the Québécois is closer to joual or what's called slang.
Bring back Jocelyn Thibault. It's the goalie coach. From Montreal to Memphis,
parlez-vous français? Indeed. Boy, I miss the Quebecers. And also the Mountie in general. Think about that, folks. Think about a time in professional wrestling past. A time of garbage men and race car drivers. A character called the Goon. A time when a main eventer in the World Wrestling Federation, the Mountie, would hit people with a fake cattle prod, and they would have to drop to the mat and start spazzing out as if they had been electrocuted. Those were the days, man. Those were the days back in the day. All right. Hurricanes Talk coming up. Game Show Thursday Talk coming up. We didn't talk Subban, me and Jeffy, because Jeff decided to go all in on defending Dennis Wyman, but stories up in Puck Daddy today. Michelle Therrien coming out calling PK Subban selfish for trying to make something happen offensively, which when you're the most offensively talented player on the team and the team's leading scorer, you tend to expect them to do that from time to time. By no means does that mean that PK made the right decision. It was a kind of iffy one. And by no means does that mean that PK had a good game, because he didn't really have a very good game against the Avalanche. But the last thing you should probably do if you're Michelle Therrien and your team is in this death spiral is call out who's been by far your best player this season for making a mistake. But he did, and that, of course, has lit the powder keg in Montreal. And I still don't think that it's going to matter. I still think Therrien's in there for the long haul. I still think that Therrien is a guy who is the caretaker of a disaster at this point. He's somebody that's going to be there through the rest of the season. Then he'll be fired. Then they'll have a lottery pick. Then hopefully Mark Bergevin addresses the problem that they have in the middle. The David Desharnais situation is resolved, i.e. he's no longer playing the minutes he plays. The Alex Galchenyuk situation is resolved, i.e. he plays in the middle. And they find a new coach. And it's going to be interesting to see what direction they go in. I already had a back and forth with somebody this morning about the fact that they have the language requirement there. And it's myopic. It's in some ways necessary. But it certainly does limit the scope of the search for who will replace Michel Therrien. But I guess the idea is that everybody's going to start putting Guy Boucher's name into the hopper. I don't know if that's the right decision or not, but fits the bill. But yeah, it's just fugly in Montreal right now. Mike Maniscalco is a post-game, pre-game host on the Buzz Radio in North Carolina, covering the Carolina Hurricanes. And we put it out there. We wanted to have some Hurricanes talk today. And, Mike, your name was put forth by the people as the man to speak to about the Hurricanes. Welcome aboard.
I feel honored. I like to think that I am for the people, of the people, and by the people here in the Triangle when it comes to covering the Canes. So thank you, guys. I am touched by the fans and even more excited to be on with you guys. I feel that I've finally made it now in my hockey journalism career.
Yes, you've made it. You've made it onto this very podcast, and Lord knows – only can go up from here as far as your career in hockey journalism.
Things are going to
as I look
happening
at
to me.
Oh yeah, you can feel it. Cue the Beck song. So the Hurricanes are such a fascinating team this season. We've talked on this podcast before about the impact Bill Peters has had, about the way they've played the game, about all the things that have gone right for them this season, and yet we still look at this team in the playoff hunt with a negative 11 goal differential on the season because of the goaltending. So the question then becomes, is there any way that this team can overcome that goaltending and actually make the playoffs with the time we have remaining?
Yeah, you know, I think there is, although this team is going to look back on quite a few games early on where, you know, they got four goals but gave up five, and that was very few that had happened. Or I should say they got three goals and gave up four. But that's in the past. If you take a look at the numbers, in particular Cam Ward before the tweak of the lower body the other night, he was 5-0-4 in his last nine games. Goals against was down, save percentages up. But you take a look at these guys' numbers, and they're skewed a little bit. And this isn't apologizing for them, but you know, the Canes did a great job this year of cutting down the shots early, but not so much the scoring chances they were giving up. So same amount of scoring chances, but you know, if you're only giving up 21 shots, your save percentage isn't going to be that high, as opposed to when Cam Ward was facing, you know, 31, 32 shots a night behind a porous defense. So while the save percentage came down, Ward has really picked up his game since December, and he should be back tomorrow night against the San Jose Sharks. That's what's expected. But Eddie Lack is, he's been feast or famine, guys. Watching him play here in Carolina, he's either going to give this team a shutout and great performance, or he gives up those juicy rebounds, and it leads to him giving up four goals a night. So while the defense has gotten much better in front, the goaltending has gotten as good behind it since, I would say, middle of December. So since then, since that run, yeah, the goaltending has been good enough. It's just the numbers were so bad at the start of the year. You look at them now, it's hard for them to balance out to where they should be.
So with all that said, when you hear rumblings that, you know, I mean, obviously Eddie Lack signed for a few seasons, Cam Ward goes UFA this summer. When you hear rumblings that they're looking to bring Ward back, it's maybe not as insane to the people that are closer to the team than it is to the people on the outside looking in and saying, how the hell can you bring Cam Ward back again?
Yeah, no, not at all. And I think part of it is getting a look at Eddie this year. And yeah, they signed him quick to that 2-year extension. But as this year has moved on, I think there's the sense of, you know, maybe Lack still needs another year before he can, you know, fully be the number one guy and carry the load. I think there's some of that with the organization when you see the number. But at the same time, you look around the league, guys, you have to have two goaltenders. I think that gone are the days of having one guy play, you know, 65, 70 games a year. You got to have two. And if Cam Ward, if the number's right and he wants to stay here, that is something that makes a lot of sense for this team. And I think the other part of it, too, why it makes sense is I don't know what the market has been out there for him. And we know that he's been an unrestricted free agent coming into this season for quite some time. The team tried to move him a little bit last year. There wasn't a market for it. Ron Francis wasn't shy about the fact that he wanted to do that. But the more you've watched him play, he's been a steady influence on this team, and he and Lack have a great relationship. They really do. So it's not like one guy's looking across the locker room at the other, you know, glaring at him, wondering why is he here. They work really well off of each other, and I think it's a relationship that right now a couple of guys in the minors are still years away, like Alex Nedeljkovic, and you know, Daniel Altschuler went to Charlotte and lit it on fire, but then he's come down to earth of late. So there's nothing really immediately in the pipeline to back up if you want to say Eddie's the guy. So if you can get a deal for 1 year or a cap-friendly number out of Cam, it's not as insane as it was if we were talking about this in October, where I'm thinking, nah, they got to choose one way or the other and see how that would work out.
Moving over to the other big pending UFA, of course, would be Eric Staal. Now, conventional wisdom from the outside looking in is that there might be the opportunity to do the old trade him, he goes somewhere, Carolina gets a bounty coming back the other way. He comes back to Carolina after the season and signs a new contract. What do you think the feasibility of that happening is?
I think that it's pretty feasible just because I don't know what the market will be for Eric outside of Carolina and the numbers that he and Rick Kern would be looking for. Although today, Eric did tell some reporters in Ottawa that he's not going to be crushed if a decision is made and he's got to move away from Carolina. Now, he didn't say forever. I think he was just going down that timeline. But I don't think it's as ridiculous as people think, even though the guy who did that the most, Jim Rutherford's in Pittsburgh, is the general manager. But it's not beyond this organization to trade away a guy and bring him back from past history. And, again, he does fit here. He likes it here. He really does enjoy living in the Triangle, and I've talked to him several times about this. But I think it's getting to the point for Eric, he just wants to get to the 29th or sooner and know his fate. Is he going to be on this team after the trade deadline, or is he going to be gone? And if he does get dealt, I wouldn't be shocked to see him come back next year as a member of the Carolina Hurricanes. I wouldn't be shocked, but it also depends on where he goes and what kind of run he goes on when he gets to a place.
Yeah, and I guess the question then becomes that money. Like, I mean, I think conventional wisdom is that he's not going to make the same amount of money against the cap that he does now. Maybe there's a contract that can be figured out as far as like total value kind of matching what he makes now. But like, where do you see the number falling? And where do you also see, like will they meet a big number for Eric Staal considering where his numbers have been the last couple of years in Carolina?
No, they won't. Although I will tell you guys, I know that a couple of months ago, the number that he's making right now, which is $9 plus million, was thrown out saying that that's what Eric was asking for. And I asked him about it. He said he's never asked or demanded that that's the number to be met in a new deal for him to stay or wherever he's going to go. For me, I don't know if it's so much a number or if it's the term. I don't know if he's looking for that, you know, that 4 year deal or that 5 year deal that a lot of guys towards the end of the career kind of want to cash in on, or if he's looking at a number. But I think that you could get him something, you know, that's similar to what his brother's making here, about $6.5 million. I think that that's something that's feasible. Then that just depends on the term that the team wants to sign him to or a team wants to sign him to. So I don't, he's not going to, and I think it would be almost ridiculous if you look at the production right now for him and his agent to think he's going to be paid what he's paid right now for anything more than a season, if that's the case. I don't see that kind of contract out there for Eric Staal right now because of the decline in the production the last couple of seasons for the Capitals.
And finally, what has been the thing? I mean, this has been a hell of a season for them. And I'm, you know, as much as I'm a Devils fan and would hate to see the Devils fail in their playoff hunt because Carolina gets in, I'll concede that it'd be really fun for the Hurricanes to get into the playoffs, being that it's a rarity. What is the thing that's impressed you most about this team this season under Bill Peters?
So you had to poke out the rarity thing, didn't you? I mean,
well, yeah, come on. I mean, like,
it's only been two playoff trips in a decade, guys. Sure,
but I'll say, but in fairness, though, and to the franchise, like, it's one of the reasons why it's one of the big bets that I use to beat back the Canadians, who always try to shit all over the Raleigh market. Because I'm saying, you know, what do you want from them? Like, they have teams have to make the playoffs more than once in a blue moon if they want to build a viable, thriving, pack the house every night fan base. So, you know, it's okay that you, I mean, it's a good excuse for the attendance stuff is what I'm trying to say.
No, that's great. And I'm glad that you do that too, because I do the same thing. I like to point out, like, in July when there's only, you know, 15,000 people at a Blue Jays game, I say there must be a Leafs game across the street, you know, because that's one of the things they like to point to ACC basketball here. But at the same time, the fascinating story to me has been the young defenseman, guys. If you would have told me that the Carolina Hurricanes by this point in the season would have three guys who are in essence, they're all rookie defensemen, but in essence under 21, 22 years of age and didn't play a single second of NHL hockey or really professional hockey to that point, and this defense would be that good. And we have given so many bouquets down here to Brett Pesce, Jacob Slavin, and Noah Hanifin is going to be really, really good. But how good they've been on the blue line. Add in Justin Falk, who is going to be out tonight, and he'll probably be out tomorrow against San Jose. They're hoping maybe he can come back on Sunday when the team takes on Tampa. But Justin Falk has been a solid, and the veterans have played really good. I mean, John Michael Lyles, this guy was a power play specialist. That was his deal. Defensively this year, if you're into the numbers, he's been as good as almost anybody you can ask for in his own end with what he's done and how responsible he's been, and he's changed into that guy who's allowed Brett Pesce to play really well on his off wing, or Jacob Slavin to play really well on his offside. And, you know, Justin Falk and Ron Hainsey have been a really good combination for this team. So it's been the blue line, and it's been fun to watch, because a few years ago, there was nothing in the system that you could point to and say could help out this team on the blue line in a year or two. And they've gone from nothing to Slavin, Pesce, Hanifin. They've got Hayden Fleury and Roland McEwen in the system. So, you know, they've got guys, blue chips on the blue line, and it's bumped out a guy like Ryan Murphy, who was supposed to be a member of the blue line in the future, and he could be a chip that they trade at the deadline. So for me, it's been fun watching these guys play. They get along. I think it's been good for them to have guys of the similar ages play and have somebody that just bounces ideas off to if they have a bad night. You know, they got somebody who they can talk to. Steve Smith has done a great job managing the minutes, too. You rarely see one of the three of those young guys playing big minutes consecutive nights. If Slavin gets it one night, it'll be Pesce the next night, and then they've been sneaking Noah Hanifin's minutes up a little bit. But for me, that's been the most fun thing to watch. And I'll give a part B. Jordan Staal's line, you want to call it a checking line, but it's not. It's the team's best line. But Jordan Staal,
right.
Joakim Nordstrom, and Andre Nestrichel, you take a look. They get the number one assignment every night. When the Canes get beat, it's not because they're getting beat by guys like Crosby and Tavares. They're getting beat by the, you know, the second and third line guys from the opposition.
Cool. Mike Maniscalco, you're our new friend, and we like you. And thanks for educating us on the Hurricanes. If you want to tell the people where they can find your work.
Well, sure. You can find a whole bunch of places. 99.9 The Fan is a home for the Canes. And for home games, if you like this voice, I'm lucky enough to be the color analyst for Chuck Caton just for the second period. They're smart enough not to give you the full game. So that's the smart thing there. And that's where you can find the pre- and post-game show. And if you're up early in the Triangle, Buzz Sports Radio, a little morning show that I co-host. So I've been up for, like, I don't know, about 9, 12, whatever many hours. And can't wait for tonight for more hockey action, 7:30 face-off against Ottawa. So you can find us online, too, WREOSportsFan.com. Have I plugged enough things? I think I'm on everything, just everything. If you're on the radio, you'll find me. So.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks, Mike. You're the best. And the Eric Staal situation is a real tough nut to crack, too. Yeah, Ian Mendez is the guy who tweeted before that comment that's burning up the interwebs. Eric Staal and his future in Carolina. I'm not going to be crushed if a decision is made and I'm moving on. Staal says he has been formally asked to waive his no-trade clause, says dialogue with Hurricanes is ongoing. Staal also said his preference is to stay in Carolina, but it's obviously clear he's come to terms with the fact that he may not be staying. But again, like we just talked about, what does that ultimately mean? Not staying now at the trade deadline? Not staying ultimately? That'll be interesting to find out what's going on there. I think, I mean, you know, brother on the team, roots down in Carolina for his entire career. Hard to imagine he's going to be moving on, like, completely. But who knows? Maybe it's time for a change. Maybe it's time for a change financially if the Hurricanes don't want to meet that price. Someone will. Think about how many donuts there are in this league. Minnesota, Montreal. Like, Eric Staal could still be a very accomplished second-line center for a team. He can make someone better in the middle pretty quickly. And someone will pay him for it. But, again, it's hard to imagine him leaving the Carolina situation. Very hard indeed to imagine that. Sam, we got game show, or is he a tough nut to crack this morning? Oh, you are? Oh. Same with Golem now. The Subban thing we talked about. Oh, okay. Subban thing we talked about everything else. So I guess it's finally time to put a little cherry on the sundae here. It's time for a Thursday favorite. It's Game Show Thursday. Joining us down the line, Stephen Thomas,
hello,
who has goalie in his email address. So I imagine that means you are or have an affinity for netminders.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Well, which one is it? Are you a goalie or do you just like them?
I'm both, yeah. I'm a goalie and I love goalies.
Yeah, I guess that's a bit. I gave you a question that really didn't make it. I mean, I tried to give you an either or, and it didn't really make any sense. Now, Stephen, you tell me that you were at our party at the Flying Saucer All Star Weekend, rocking the number 29 yeah. Marty Brodeur jersey. True or false?
True.
What kind of hipster gets the number 29 Marty Brodeur jersey?
That's a good question. But
yeah,
definitely a hipster.
It's a hipster move. All right, listen.
I wanted one that nobody else would get the joke.
Except for Devils fans who remember the hockey cards with Marty with the flat top and terrible mustache, the early Brodeur days when he rocked the 2-9.
Yeah, definitely.
Instead of the 3-0. Who's your favorite? Because you're a Predators fan. Yes. Outside of any Predators goaltender, who is your favorite goalie in the league right now?
I love Ben Scrivens. He's just such a cool guy.
What?
He seems like he's such a cool guy.
Wow, that was not the answer I was expecting. Maybe I would have guessed maybe like 20 goalies before I would have gotten to Ben Scrivens. What is it about Scrivens that you like so much? I mean, insofar as his coolness goes.
I followed him on Twitter for a while, and he just seemed like this cool guy, really outspoken, just kind of does a lot for different kind of communities. Just a cool guy, you know.
Social media making a star, making a beloved figure in your world. A bit of the Paul Bissonnette of goalies, then, as Twitter
makes someone
endearing. Yeah, exactly. Except never talking about panty soup like being asked to use to. All right, Stephen. Well, you are our contestant here for Game Show Thursday. I'm just dropping the Friday. We're probably never playing it on Friday again. So you know how it works. It's five rounds, three categories each round. You get to pick the category you want to play. You get three rounds correct, and then you go off to the prize closet, the co-branded Sportsnet/Yahoo prize closet, where Sam will dig out something and send it to you for your victory. But if you fail, then you just become yet another victim of Game Show Thursday. There have been many lately. Are you ready to play Game Show Thursday on the Merrick Vershinsky podcast?
Yes, sir. Let's go.
All right, here we go. Stephen Thomas from Nashville. You actually live in Nashville or you live around Nashville?
I go to school in Martin, which is about 2.5 hours away. But,
okay.
On the weekends, I live in Murfreesboro. It's like half an hour away.
Did you hear my comments about hot chicken and how much I hated it?
Yeah, I don't eat it all that much.
Okay.
I had it like a couple weeks ago, and it was all right, but not amazingly into it.
Because I had it at Party Foul, and again, I don't know if maybe I just had it. It was too hot. Maybe I wasn't in the right mood for it. I did have to ration it out because I had interviews to do and I didn't want to have it be like my whole mouth was numb. But I still sometimes feel a twinge of pain in my stomach thinking about how hot it was. I feel like I bit into a xenomorph in Aliens and their acid blood is still churning in my belly. That's how hot it was.
That's almost verbatim what my mom said.
All right. Enough of this. That's funny. All right, your first round, you get three choices. Your categories are hockey at the White House, NHL stats, and NHL salaries. Which one would you like?
Geez. Let's go hockey at the White House.
All right, current events question. The Chicago Blackhawks went to the White House today to meet with President Obama. And which one of these things did the Blackhawks not give Obama upon meeting him at the White House this morning? A, his own Blackhawks jersey. B, one of Corey Crawford's masks. C, a painting depicting their dynasty. Or D, a United Center parking pass.
I gotta assume they gave him a jersey, and I saw something on Twitter about a parking pass. So, I'm gonna guess Corey Crawford's mask.
That is correct. Well done, sir. They did, in fact, give him a painting depicting their dynasty, which is an amazing level of hubris, but what we've come to expect from a John McDonough team. So congratulations.
Does that go in the White House, or does that go into, like, a Chicago home? Like,
I don't know where it would go. I assume that it'll be one day go into the Obama Library, which I assume will be somewhere in Illinois. But, I mean, as for right now, I doubt it's going to, like, replace a painting of Lincoln in the Lincoln bedroom, with like a picture of like Andrew Shaw, bleeding from the eye. Round two, your categories are NHL Spelling Bee, Nashville Predators goalies, or the Stanley Cup itself.
Well, Nashville Predators goalies then. Gotta combine.
All right. Very, very good. Very good. A category you requested. Pekka Rene is first in franchise wins with 224. We all knew that. We all know that Thomas Vokoun is second in team wins, franchise-wise, with 161. Obviously, he's the other guy who played the most games. Who is number three in victories all time for the Nashville Predators?
It's between Chris Mason and Mike Dunham, I'd have to think. I'm going to go with Mason, Chris Mason.
Well, you've chosen poorly. It is Mike Dunham. 81 career victories. He is number three all time. But well done, avoiding the, you know, Anders Lindback pitfall or really any of the other
Michael
number
Layton.
Of the Michael Layton. Yes, right. Dan Ellis. You know, the list goes on and on. Wow, going old school there. All right, round three. So you're one for two. Round three, we have the classic Game Show Thursday category, NHL threesomes, minor league team names, and Michelle Therrien trivia. Which one would you like?
The minor league team names, please.
An excellent choice. As you know, usually multiple choice, and it is, of course, multiple choice once again. Which one of these Southern Professional Hockey League teams never existed? The Fayetteville Fire Ants, the Pensacola Ice Flyers, the Winston-Salem Polar Twins, or the Athens Chariots?
The Pensacola Ice Flyers used to play in Nashville. They were the Knights. So what was the – was there a Winston-Salem one, was that?
So I'll give them all to you again. The Fayetteville Fire Ants, the Pensacola Ice Flyers, the Winston-Salem Polar Twins, or the Athens Chariots?
Let's go with the Polar Twins. They didn't exist.
I'm sorry. The Polar Twins actually did exist. It's the generically named Athens Chariots that we were looking for. And now, Stephen, we've come to an uncomfortable part of the game where, lo and behold, you are one incorrect question away from elimination.
Okay.
Let's do this again. NHL salaries, the state of hockey, and the records of Alex Ovechkin. Those are your categories.
The records of Alex Ovechkin.
The records of Alex Ovechkin. Alex Ovechkin has 510 goals, which is third among active players. Now, we all know Jaromír Jágr is first, and we all know that Jerome McGinley is second. But who is right behind Alex Ovechkin, fourth among active players with 496 goals? Oh, ain't easy.
No, it isn't.
I'll give you a hint. It is not Martin Irat.
Oh, geez.
Fourth among active players in goals scored with 496. I'll give you a hint. Western Conference. All right. Your answer, please.
Jesus. Henrik Sedin. I don't know. This is bad.
I mean, Daniel's the goal scorer, as anyone who listens to the Bill Simmons podcast when I appeared on it knows. But no, the name we were looking for was Marian Hossa. Marian Hossa, 496 goals, veteran winger. Steven, I'm sorry, but you were not a successful contestant on Game Show Thursday. This has not been a very good run for contestants. Everybody's been losing lately, and it's been very depressing. So don't feel bad about it. The questions were quite hard. But I'll give you one more just for shits and giggles.
Yep.
The state of hockey, because obviously the Stadium Series game is happening this weekend in Minnesota. A Minnesota-centric question for you to answer, and for all the people at home to answer.
All right.
This defenseman turned assistant coach is the all-time leading scorer for Minnesota-born players with 1,232 career points. Can you name
it? Is it Phil Housley?
It is, in fact, Phil Housley. And so, at the same time, I like giving people a chance to play at home, and then I also like to kind of rub your face in a little bit that you maybe picked the wrong category.
Yeah, I played at Bridgestone against him one time, just like a pickup game. He went, right at the blue line, post then. Just an amazing shot. He's like 50.
And skinny as a piece of straw, that one. I mean, I don't even know how he was able to play in this league. So slight, but a marvelous offensive defenseman. Maybe not the best defensive defenseman, but a marvelous offensive defenseman. Well, Steven, I'm sorry things didn't work out. Anything you'd like to plug or say to the listeners in your waning moments here on the podcast?
Challenge Athletes Playing Equally is a kind of a nonprofit that I volunteer for. If you want to donate or do anything for them, capetn.org. And if anybody knows a witch doctor, if we can get Pecorino back to a 915 save percentage, that'd be great.
Are you guys going to make the playoffs? What do you think?
I don't know.
I don't know if you heard Merrick before, but he said that he expects Scott Hartnell to be traded back to Nashville before the deadline. Do you want Hartnell back?
It couldn't hurt, you know, but I think the problem is right now on Pecorino's shoulders. It's just rough watching.
Yeah, I agree, man. Like I think they'd be in prime real estate when it comes to the playoff seating were it not for him not playing up the snuff, and it's gonna just take him playing out of it. It's been inexplicable, but they'll figure it. I think they'll figure it out. I think they're a playoff team this year. But we'll see.
Let's hope.
Steven, you're the cat's pajamas, the bee's knees for coming on the show and doing this. Thanks for being a dedicated listener. Thanks for coming out to that party. And we'll talk to you down the line, sir.
Sounds good. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, bud. I don't mess around on Game Show Thursday. I'm sorry. There are people out there that are like, why do you give so many layups? These are not layups. These are very tough questions. Very tough questions. And compounded by the fact that once you start spiraling down the abyss, as we've seen through the years on Game Show Friday, now Thursday, it's very hard to fire your grappling hook from your utility belt and swing out of danger. So while many of you may have been screaming Marian Hossa at your listening devices, it's not so easy when you know that you are facing elimination if you get it wrong. Thanks to Jeff Merrick. Thanks to Mike Maniscalco for coming on and talking Hurricanes hockey. We tried, I should tell you, we originally tried to get somebody from Vancouver to talk Canucks, but the timing of things was weird because of when the show tapes. So we'll try again. Like, I know there's, the Canucks are a fascinating team and, in a weird place franchise-wise, and we do want to talk about them, so hopefully next week we can hook something up. But until then, no show tomorrow, back on Sunday, Monday area, probably, Monday, I don't know. I don't know when we're doing it again, Sammy, because I got a thing on Monday at the University of Maryland that might trip us up.
Ooh, big shot.
Yeah, we could figure it out. I might have to go remote on that or something. I don't know.
I'll figure it out.
Yeah, I'm traveling Sunday too, so we'll figure it out. We're professionals. And that's it. Thanks everybody for listening. Thanks everybody for the kind words on the Lozocast on Wednesday. Really, you know, intense conversation about James Lipton as a French pimp and the virtues of Red Lobster. All the hockey talk that you can handle as usual. Puck Daddy, do check it out today for stuff on Terry and Subban, stuff on the Flint Firebirds. Josh Cooper will be on site for the Stadium Series game in Minnesota, so plenty of stuff coming from him. And then a reminder on January 29th, that Monday, mega super wombo trade deadline experience on PD. We'll have live blogs on the hour. We'll have special videos, special podcasts. Me, Sean Leahy, and according to what I heard yesterday from him, Dave Lozo, all in the same room, rocking out the content for trade deadline. So it should be fun. All right, great week. Thanks again to Sam. Thanks again to everybody else. And we'll talk to you down the line. Bye. Thank you.